The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the 14th reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna. I'm Anna McLean. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. Fian goes into town, and the streets are crowded with people being forced on buses. She sees a friend who begs her to take her son. Later, she brings the boy to the convent orphanage, but Mother Superior says she must get papers for him. Meanwhile, Isabel has recovered and is back transporting flyers across the Pyrenees to safety. Portland, Oregon, 1995. Isabel is boarding a plane for Paris with her son, Julian. Now we continue with The Nightingale. Do you need a place to stay? Papa said. Isabel appreciated the offer. It reminded her of how far they'd come. They still weren't close, but they were working together, and that was something. He no longer pushed her away, and now, here, an invitation. It gave her hope that someday, when the war was over, they could actually talk. I can't. It would put you at risk. She hadn't been to the apartment in more than 18 months. Neither had she been to Caraval or seen Vianne in all that time. Rarely had Isabel spent 3 nights in the same place. Her life was a series of hidden rooms and dusty mattresses and suspicious strangers. Have you heard anything about your sister? I have friends looking out for her. I hear she is taking no chances, keeping her head down and her daughter safe. She will be fine, she said, hearing how hope softened that last sentence. You miss her, he said. Isabel found herself thinking of the past suddenly, wishing she could just let it go. Yes, she missed her sister, but she had missed Vianne for years, for all of her life. Well, he stood up abruptly. She noticed his hands. Your hands are shaking. I quit drinking. It seemed like a bad time to be a drunk. I don't know about that, she said, smiling up at him. Drunk seems like a good idea these days. Be careful, Juliet. Her smile faded. Every time she saw anyone these days, it was hard to say goodbye. You never knew if you'd see them again. You too. Midnight. Isabel crouched in the darkness behind a crumbling stone wall. She was deep in the woods and dressed in peasant clothes, denim overalls that had seen better days, wooden-soled boots, and a lightweight blouse made from an old shower curtain. Downwind, she could smell the smoke of nearby bonfires, but she couldn't see even a glimmer of firelight. Behind her, a twig snapped. She crouched lower, barely breathed. A whistle sounded. It was the lilting song of the nightingale, or close to it. She whistled back. She heard footsteps, breathing, and then, is? She rose and turned around. A thin beam of light swept past her and then snapped off. She stepped over a fallen log and into Gaetan's arms. I missed you, he said after a kiss, drawing back with a reluctance she could feel. They had not seen each other for more than 8 months. Every time she heard of a train derailing or a German-occupied hotel being blown up or a skirmish with partisans, she worried. He took her hand and led her through a forest so dark she couldn't see the man beside her or the trail beneath their feet. Gaetan never turned on his torchlight. He knew these woods intimately, having lived here for well over a year. At the end of the woods, they came to a huge grassy field where people stood in rows. They held torchlights, which they swept forward and back like beacons, illuminating the flat area between the trees. She heard an aeroplane engine overhead, felt the whoosh of air on her cheeks, and smelled exhaust. It swooped in above them, flying low enough to make the trees shudder. She heard a loud mechanical scree and the banging of metal on metal, and then a parachute appeared, falling, a huge box swinging beneath it. Weapons drop, Gaetan said. Tugging her hand, he led her into the trees again and up a hill, to the encampment deep in the forest. In its center, a bonfire glowed bright orange, its light hidden by the thick fringe of trees. Several men stood around the fire, smoking cigarettes and talking. Most had come here to avoid the STO, compulsory deportation to forced labor camps in Germany. Once here, they had taken up arms and became partisans who fought a guerrilla war with Germany in secret under cover of night, the Maquis. They bombed trains and blew up munitions dumps and flooded canals and did whatever else they could to disrupt the flow of goods and men from France to Germany. They got their supplies and their information from the Allies. Their lives were always at risk. When found by the enemy, reprisals were swift and often brutal. Burning, cattle prods, blinding, each Maquis fighter carried a cyanide pill in his pocket. The men looked unwashed, starving, haggard. Most wore brown corduroy pants and black berets, all of which were frayed and patched and faded. For all that Isabel believed in their cause, she wouldn't want to be alone up here. "Come," Gaetan said. He led her past the bonfire to a small, dirty-looking tent with a canvas flap that was open to reveal a single sleeping bag and a pile of clothes and a pair of muddy boots. As usual, it smelled of dirty socks and sweat. Isabel ducked her head and crouched low as she made her way inside. Gaetan sat down beside her and closed the flap. He didn't light a lamp. The men would see their silhouettes within and start catcalling. "Isabel," he said, "I've missed you." She leaned forward, let herself be taken in his arms, and kissed. When it ended, too soon, she took a deep breath. "I have a message for your group from London. Paul received it at 5 p.m. tonight. Long sobs of autumn violins." She heard him draw in a breath. Obviously, the words, which they'd received over radio from the BBC, were a code. "Is it important?" she asked. His hands moved to her face, held her gently, and drew her in for another kiss. This one was full of sadness. Another goodbye. "Important enough that I have to leave right now." All she could do was nod. "There's never any time," she whispered. Every moment they'd ever had together had been stolen somehow, or wrested. They met, they ducked into shadowy corners or dirty tents or back rooms, and they made love in the dark, but they didn't get to lie together afterward like lovers and talk. He was always leaving her, or she was leaving him. Each time he held her, she thought, "This will be it, the last time I see him." And she waited for him to say he loved her. She told herself that it was war, that he did love her, but he was afraid of that love, afraid he would lose her. And it would hurt more somehow if he declared himself. On good days, she even believed it. "How dangerous is it, this thing you're going off to do?" Again, the silence. "I'll find you," he said quietly. "Maybe I'll come to Paris for a night, and we'll sneak into the cinema and boo at the newsreels and walk through the Rodin gardens." "Like lovers," she said, trying to smile. It was what they always said to each other, this dream shared of a life that seemed impossible to remember and unlikely to reoccur. He touched her face with a gentleness that brought tears to her eyes. "Like lovers." In the past 18 months, as the war had escalated and Nazi aggression mounted, Vianne had found and hidden 13 children at the orphanage. At first, she had canvassed the nearby countryside, following leads given to her by the OSCE. In time, Mother had connected with the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, an umbrella group for Jewish charities in the United States that funded the struggle to save Jewish children. And they brought Vianne into contact with more children in need. Mothers sometimes showed up on her doorstep, crying, desperate, begging her for help. Vianne never turned anyone away, but she was always terrified. Now, on a warm June day in 1944, a week after the Allies had landed more than 150,000 troops in Normandy, Vianne stood in her classroom at the orphanage, staring out at the children who sat slumped and tired at their desks. Of course they were tired. In the past year, the bombing had rarely stopped. Air raids were so constant that Vianne no longer bothered to take her children into the cellar pantry when the alarm sounded at night. She just lay in bed with them, holding them tightly until either all clear sounded or the bombing stopped. It never stopped for long. Vianne clapped her hands together and called for attention. Perhaps a game would lift their spirits. "Is it another air raid, madame?" asked Emile. He was 6 years old now and never mentioned his mamma anymore. When asked, he said that she died because she got sick, and that was all there was to it. He had no memory at all of being Jean-Georges Rouet. just as Daniel had no memory of who he used to be. "No, no air raid," she said. "Actually, I was thinking that it's awfully hot in here." She tugged at her loose collar. "That's because of the blackout windows, madame," said Claudine, formerly Bernadette. "Mother says she feels like a smoked ham in her woolen habit." The children laughed at that. "It's better than the winter cold," Sophie said, and to this there was a round of nodding agreement. "I was thinking," Vianne said, "that today would be a good day to..." Before she could finish her thought, she heard the clatter of a motorcycle outside. Moments later, footsteps, jackboots, thundered down the stone corridor. Everyone went still. The door to her classroom opened. Von Richter walked into the room. As he approached Vianne, he removed his hat and tucked it beneath his armpit. "Madame," he said, "will you step into the corridor with me?" Vianne nodded. "One moment, children," she said. "Read quietly while I am gone." Von Richter took her by the arm, a painful, punishing grip, and led her into the stone courtyard outside her classroom. The sound of falling water from the mossy fountain gurgled nearby. "I am here to ask about an acquaintance of yours, Henri Navarre." Vianne prayed she didn't flinch. "Who, Herr Sturmbannführer?" "Henri Navarre." "Ah, oui, the hotelier." She fisted her hands to still them. "You are his friend?" Vianne shook her head. "No, Herr Sturmbannführer. I know of him merely. It is a small town." Von Richter gave her an assessing look. "If you are lying to me about something so simple, I will perhaps wonder what else you are lying to me about." "Herr Sturmbannführer, no." "You have been seen with him." His breath smelled of beer and bacon, and his eyes were narrowed. "He'll kill me," she thought for the first time. She'd been careful for so long, never antagonizing him or defying him, never making eye contact if she could help it. But in the last few weeks, he had become volatile, impossible to predict. "It is a small town, but he has been arrested for aiding the enemy, madame." "Oh," she said. "I will speak to you more about this, madame, in a small room with no windows. And believe me, I will get the truth out of you. I will find out if you are working with him." "Me?" He tightened his hold so much she thought her bones might crack. "If I find that you knew anything about this, I will question your children intensely, and then I will send you all to Fresnes prison." "Don't hurt them, I beg you." It was the first time she'd ever begged him for anything, and at the desperation in her voice, he went perfectly still. His breathing accelerated, and there it was, as plain as the blue of his eyes, arousal. For more than a year and a half, she had conducted herself with scrupulous care in his presence, dressing and acting like a little wren, never drawing his attention, never saying anything beyond yes or no, Herr Sturmbannführer. Now in an instant, all of that was undone. She had revealed her weakness, and he had seen it. He knew how to hurt her now. Hours later, Vianne was in a windowless room in the bowels of the town hall. She sat stiffly upright in her chair, her hands clamped around the armrest so tightly that her knuckles were white. She had been here for a long time, alone, trying to decide what the best answers would be. How much did they know? What would they believe? Had Henri named her? No, if they knew that she had forged documents and hidden Jewish children, she would already have been arrested. Behind her, the door creaked open and then clicked shut. "Madame Mauriac." She got to her feet. Von Richter circles her slowly, his gaze intimate on her body. She was wearing a faded, often repaired dress and no stockings, and oxfords with wooden soles. Her hair, unwashed for 2 days, was covered by a gingham turban with a knot above her forehead. Her lipstick had run out long ago, and so her lips were pale. He came to a stop in front of her, too close, his hands clasped behind his back. It took courage to tilt her chin upward, and when she did, when she looked in his ice-blue eyes, she knew she was in trouble. "You were seen with Henri Navarre walking in the square. He is suspected of working with the Marquis de Limousin, those cowards who live like animals in the woods and aided the enemy in Normandy." At the same time as the Allied landing at Normandy, the Marquis had wreaked havoc across the country, cutting train lines, setting bombs, flooding canals. The Nazis were desperate to find and punish the partisans. "I am barely acquainted with him, Herr Sturmbannführer. I know nothing of men who aid the enemy. Are you making a fool of me, madame? She shook her head. He wanted to hit her. She could see it in his blue eyes, an ugly, sick desire. It had been planted when she'd begged him for something, and now she had no idea how to eradicate it. He reached out and grazed a finger along her jaw. She flinched. Are you truly so innocent? Herr Sturmbannfuhrer, you have lived in my home for 18 months. You see me every day. I feed my children and work in my garden and teach at the orphanage. I am hardly aiding the Allies. His fingertips caressed her mouth, forcing her lips to part slightly. If I find out that you are lying to me, I will hurt you, madame, and I will enjoy it. He let his hand fall away. But if you tell the truth, now I will spare you and your children. She shivered at the thought of his finding out that he had been living all this time with a Jewish child. It would make a fool of him. I would never lie to you, Herr Sturmbannfuhrer. You must know that. Here's what I know, he said, leaning closer, whispering in her ear. I hope you are lying to me, madame. He drew back. You are scared, he said, smiling. I have nothing to be afraid of, she said, unable to get much volume in her voice. We shall see if that is true. For now, madame, go home, and pray I do not discover that you have lied to me. That same day, Isabel walked up the cobblestone street in the hilltop town of Orium. She could hear the echo of footsteps behind her. On the journey here from Paris, her two latest songs, Major Foley and Sergeant Smythe, had followed her instructions perfectly and had made it past the various checkpoints. She hadn't looked back in quite some time, but she had no doubt that they were there, walking as instructed, with at least 100 yards between them. At the top of the hill, she saw a man seated on a bench in front of the closed poste. He held a sign that read, "Deaf and dumb, waiting for my maman to pick me up." Amazingly, this simple ruse still worked to fool the Nazis. Isabel went to him. "I have an umbrella," she said in her heavily accented English. "It looks like rain," he said. She nodded. "Walk at least 50 yards behind me." She kept walking up the hill, alone. By the time she reached Madame Babineau's property, it was nearing nightfall. At the bend in the road, she paused, waiting for her airman to catch up. The man who'd been seated on the bench was the first to arrive. "Hello, ma'am," he said, pulling off his borrowed beret. "Major Tom Dowd, ma'am, and I'm to say best wishes from Sarah and Paul, ma'am. She was a first-rate hostess." Isabel smiled tiredly. They were so larger-than-life, these Yanks, with their ready smiles and booming voices, and their gratitude, not at all like the Brits, who thanked her with clipped words and cool voices and firm handshakes. She'd lost track of the times an American had hugged her so tightly she'd come off her feet. "I'm Juliet," she said to the major. Major Jack Foley was next to arrive. He gave her a big smile and said, "Those are some mountains." "You said a mouthful there," Dowd said, thrusting his hand out. "Dowd, Chicago." "Foley, Boston. Nice to meet you." Sergeant Smythe brought up the rear. He arrived a few minutes later. "Hello, gentlemen," he said stiffly. "That was a hike." "Just wait," Isabel said with a laugh. She led them to the cottage and knocked 3 times on the front door. Madame Babineau opened the door a little, saw Isabel through the crack, and grinned, stepping back to allow them entrance. As always, a cast-iron cauldron hung above the flames in the soot-blackened fireplace. The table was set for their arrival, with glasses of warm milk and empty soup bowls. Isabel glanced around. "Eduardo?" "In the barn with 2 more airmen. We are having trouble getting supplies. It's all this damn bombing. Half of town is rubble." She placed a hand on Isabel's cheek. "You look tired, Isabel. Are you well?" The touch was so comforting that Isabel couldn't help leaning into it for just a moment. She wanted to tell her friend her troubles, unburden herself for a moment, but that was another luxury lost in this war. Troubles were carried alone. Isabel didn't tell Madame Babineau that the Gestapo had broadened their search for the Nightingale, or that she worried for her father and sister and niece. What was the point? They all had family to worry about. Such were ordinary anxieties, fixed points on the map of this war. Isabel reached out for the old woman's hands. There were so many terrible aspects to what their lives now were, But there was this, too, friendships forged in fire that had proven to be as strong as iron. After so many solitary years spent tucked away in convents and forgotten in boarding schools, Isabel never took for granted the fact that now she had friends, people whom she cared about and who cared about her. "I am fine, my friend. And that handsome man of yours? Still bombing depots and derailing trains. I saw him just before the invasion in Normandy. I could tell something big was up. I know he's in the thick of it. I'm worried." Isabel heard the distant purr of an engine. She turned to Madame. "Are you expecting anyone?" "No one ever drives up here." The airmen heard it too. They paused in their conversation. Smythe looked up. Foley drew a knife out of his waistband. Outside, the goat started bleeding. A shadow moved across the window. Before Isabel could yell out a warning, the door smacked open and light poured into the room, along with several SS agents. "Put your hands over your heads." Isabel was hit hard in the back of the head by a rifle butt. She gasped and stumbled forward. Her legs gave out beneath her, and she fell hard, cracking her head on the stone floor. The last thing she heard before she lost consciousness was, "You are all under arrest." Chapter 33. Isabel woke tied to a wooden chair at her wrists and ankles. The ropes bit into her flesh and were so tight she couldn't move. Her fingers were numb. A single light bulb hung from the ceiling above her, a cone of light in the darkness. The room smelled of mold and piss and water seeping through cracks in the stone. Somewhere in front of her, a match flared. She heard the scratch of sound, smelled the sulfur, and tried to lift her head, but the movement hurt so much she made an involuntary sound. "Gut," someone said. "It hurts." Gestapo. He pulled a chair from the darkness and sat down, facing her. "Pain," he said simply. "Or no pain. The choice is yours." "In that case, no pain." He hit her hard. Blood filled her mouth, sharp and metallic tasting. She felt it dribble down her chin. 2 days, she thought. Only 2 days. She had to last under questioning for 48 hours without naming names. If she could do that, just not crack, her father and Gaetan and Henri and Didier and Paul and Anouk would have time to protect themselves. They would know soon enough that she had been arrested, if they didn't already know. Eduardo would get the word out, and then he would go into hiding. That was their plan. "Name," he said, withdrawing a small notebook and a pencil from his breast pocket. She felt blood dripping down her chin, onto her lap. "Juliette Gervais. But you know that. You have my papers." "We have papers that name you as Juliette Gervais." "True. So why ask me?" "Who are you, really?" "I'm really Juliet." "Born where?" he asked lazily, studying his well-tended fingernails. "Nice." "And what were you doing in Aryun?" "I was in Aryun," she said. He straightened at that. His gaze returned to hers with interest. "How old are you?" 22, or nearly, I think. Birthdays don't mean much anymore. "You look younger." "I feel older." He slowly got to his feet, towered over her. "You work for the Nightingale. I want his name." They didn't know who she was. "I know nothing about birds." The blow came out of the blue, stunning in its impact. Her head whipped sideways, cracked hard against the chair back. "Tell me about the Nightingale." "I told you." This time he hit her with an iron ruler across the cheek, so hard she felt her skin break open and blood spill. He smiled and said again, "The Nightingale." She spat as hard as she could, but it came out as a dribbling blob of blood that landed in her lap. She shook her head to clear her vision and wished immediately that she hadn't. He was coming toward her again, methodically slapping the red dripping ruler into his open palm. "I'm Rittmeister Schmidt, commandant of the Gestapo in Amboise, and you are..." "He is going to kill me," Isabel thought. She struggled against her restraints, breathing hard. She tasted her own blood. "Juliet," she whispered, desperate now that he believed her. She couldn't last 2 days. This was the risk everyone had warned her about, the terrible truth of what she'd been doing. How had it seemed like an adventure? She would get herself and everyone she cared about killed. "We have most of your compatriots. There is no sense in you dying to protect dead men." Was it true? No, if it were true, she would be dead too. Juliette Gervais, she said again. He backhanded her with the ruler so hard the chair toppled sideways and crashed to the floor. Her head cracked on the stone. At the same time, he kicked her in the stomach with the toe of his boot. The pain was like nothing she'd ever known. She heard him say, "Now, mademoiselle, name the nightingale." And she couldn't have answered if she wanted to. He kicked her again, with all his weight behind the blow. Consciousness brought pain. Everything hurt. Her head, her face, her body. It took effort and courage to lift her head. She was still bound at the ankles and wrists. The ropes chafed against her torn, bloodied skin, cut into her bruised flesh. Where am I? Darkness surrounded her, and not an ordinary darkness, not an unlit room. This was something else, an impenetrable, inky blackness that pressed against her battered face. She sensed a wall was mere inches from her face. She tried to make the smallest move of her foot to reach forward, and pain roared to life again, biting deep into the rope cuts on her ankles. She was in a box, and she was cold. She could feel her breath and knew it would be visible. Her nostril hairs was frozen. She shivered hard, uncontrollably. She screamed in terror. The sound of her scream echoed back at her and was lost. Freezing. Isabel shuddered with cold, whimpering. She could feel her breath now, pluming in front of her face, turning to frost on her lips. Her eyelashes were frozen. Think, Isabel. Don't give up. She moved her body a little, fighting through the cold and pain. She was seated, still bound at the ankles and wrists, naked. She closed her eyes, sickened by the image of him undressing her, touching her when she was unconscious. In the fetid darkness, she became aware of a thrumming noise. At first, she thought it was her blood pulsing in pain, or her heart pounding a desperate beat to stay alive, but it wasn't that. It was a motor, and nearby, humming. She recognized the sound, but what was it? She shuddered again, trying to wiggle her fingers and toes to combat the dead feeling that had overtaken her extremities. Before there was pain in her feet, and then a tingling, and now nothing. She moved the only thing she could, her head, and it thunked against something hard. She was naked, tied to a chair, inside a frozen, dark, humming, small, a refrigerator. She panicked, tried frantically to wrest free, to topple her prison, but all her effort did was wind her, defeat her. She couldn't move, not anything except her fingers and toes, which were too frozen to cooperate. Not like this, please. She would freeze to death or be asphyxiated. Her own breathing echoed back at her, surrounded her, a shudder of breath all around it. She started to cry, and her tears froze, turning to icicles on her cheeks. She thought of all the people she loved, Vianne, Sophie, Gaetan, her father. Why hadn't she told them that she loved them every day when she had the chance, and now she would die without ever saying a word to Vianne? Vianne, she thought, only that, the name, part prayer, part regret, part goodbye. A dead body hung from every street lamp in the town square. Vianne came to a stop, unable to believe what she was seeing. Across the way, an old woman stood beneath one of the bodies. The air was full of the whining creak of ropes pulled taut. Vianne moved cautiously through the square, taking care to keep away from the street lamps. Blue-faced, swollen, slack bodies. There had to be 10 dead men here, Frenchmen, she could tell, Macaisans by the look of them, the rough guerrilla partisans of the woods. They wore brown pants and black berets and tricolor armbands. Vianne went to the old woman, took her by the shoulders. "You should not be here," she said. "My son," the woman croaked, "he can't stay here." "Come," Vianne said, less gently this time. She maneuvered the old woman out of the square. On Rue La Grande, the woman pulled free and walked away, mumbling to herself, crying. Vianne passed three more dead bodies on her way to the Boucherie. Caraveau seemed to be holding its breath. The Allied had bombed the area repeatedly in the last few months, and several of the town's buildings had been reduced to rubble. Something always seemed to be falling down or crumbling. The air smelled of death, and the town was silent. Danger lurked in every shadow, around every corner. In the queue at the butcher shop, Vian heard women talking, their voices lowered. Retaliation, worse than Tulle. Did you hear about Oradour sur Glane? Even with all of that, with all of the arrests and deportations and executions, Vian couldn't believe the newest rumors. Yesterday morning, the Nazis had marched into the small village of Oradour sur Glane, not far from Carrefour, and herded everyone at gunpoint into the town's church, supposedly to check their papers. Everyone in town, whispered the woman to whom Vian had spoken. Men, women, children. The Nazis shot them all. Then they slammed the doors shut, locked them all in, and burned the church to the ground. Her eyes welled with tears. It's true. It can't be, Vian said. My Didi saw them shoot a pregnant woman in the belly. She saw this? Vian asked. The old woman nodded. Didi hid out for hours behind a rabbit hutch and saw the town in flames. She said she'll never forget the screaming. Not everyone was dead when they set the fire. It was supposedly in retaliation for a Sturmbannführer who'd been captured by the Maquis. Would the same thing happen here? The next time the war went badly, would the Gestapo or SS round up the villagers of Carrefour and trap them in the town hall and open fire? She took the small tin of oil that this week's ration card had allowed her and walked out of the shop, flipping up her hood to shield her face. Someone grabbed her by the arm and pulled her hard to the left. She stumbled sideways, lost her footing, and almost fell. He pulled her into a dark alley and revealed himself. Papa, Vian said, too stunned by his appearance to say more. She saw what the war had done to him, how it had etched lines in his forehead and placed puffy bags of flesh beneath his tired-looking eyes, how it had leached the color from his skin and turned his hair white. He was terribly thin. Age spots dotted his sagging cheeks. She was reminded of his return from the Great War, when he'd looked this bad. "Is there somewhere quiet we can talk?" he said. "I'd rather not meet your German." "He's not my German, but we..." She could hardly blame him for not wanting to meet von Richter. The house next to mine is vacant, to the east. The Germans thought it too small to bother with. We can meet there. In 20 minutes, he said. Vian pulled her hood back up over her scarf-covered hair and stepped out of the alleyway. As she left town and walked along the muddy road toward home, she tried to imagine why her father was here. She knew, or supposed, that Isabel was living with him in Paris, although even that was conjecture. For all she knew, her sister and her father lived separate lives in the same city. She hadn't heard from Isabel since that terrible night in the barn, although Henri had reported that she was well. She hurried past the airfield, barely noticing the aeroplanes that were crumpled and still smoking from a recent bombing raid. At Rachel's gate, she paused and glanced up and down the road. No one had followed her or seemed to be watching her. She slipped inside the yard and hurried to the abandoned cottage. The front door had been broken long ago and now hung askew. She let herself inside. The interior was shadowy and limned in dust. Almost all of the furniture had been requisitioned or stolen by looters, and missing pictures left black squares on the walls. Only an old love seat with dirty cushions and a broken leg remained in the living room. Vian sat down, perched nervously, her foot tapping on the rush-covered floor. She chewed on her thumbnail, unable to be still, and then she heard footsteps. She went to the window, lifting the blackout shade. Her father was at the door. Only he wasn't her father, not this stooped old man. She let him into the house. When he looked at her, the lines in his face deepened. The folds of his skin looked like pockets of melting wax. He ran a hand through his thinning hair. The long white strands rearranged themselves into spikes, giving him a strangely electrified look. He moved toward her slowly, limping just a little. It brought her whole life back in an instant, that shuffling, awkward way he had of moving. Her maman said, "Forgive him, Vian. He isn't himself anymore, and he can't forgive himself. It's up to us to do it." Vian He said her name softly, his rough voice lingering over it. Again, she was reminded subtly of before, when he had been himself. It was a long-forgotten thought. In the after years, she had relegated all thoughts of him to the closet. In time, she'd forgotten. Now she remembered. It scared her to feel this way. He had hurt her so many times. Papa. He went to the love seat and sat down. The cushion sagged tiredly beneath his meager weight. I was a terrible father to you girls. It was so surprising and true that Vianne had no idea what to say. He sighed. It's too late now to fix all that. She joined him at the love seat, sat down beside him. It's never too late, she said cautiously. Was it true? Could she forgive him? Yes. The answer came instantly, as unexpected as his appearance here. He turned to her. I have so much to say and no time to say it. Stay here, she said. I'll care for you. And Isabel has been arrested and charged with aiding the enemy. She's imprisoned in Giraud. Vianne drew in a sharp breath. The regret she felt was immense, as was the guilt. What had her last words to her sister been? Don't come back. What can we do? We, he said. It is a lovely question, but not one to be asked. You must do nothing. You stay here in Caravo and stay out of trouble, as you have been. Keep my granddaughter safe. Await your husband. It was all Vianne could do not to say, I'm different now, Papa. I am helping to hide Jewish children. She wanted to see herself reflected in his gaze, wanted just once to make him proud of her. Do it. Tell him. How could she? He looked so old sitting there, old and broken and lost. There was only the barest hint of the man he'd been. He didn't need to know that Vianne was risking her life, too. Couldn't worry that he would lose both his daughters. Let him think she was as safe as one could be. A coward. Isabel will need you to come home, too, when this is over. You will tell her that she did the right thing. She will worry about that one day. She will think she should have stayed with you, protected you. She will remember leaving you with the Nazi, risking your lives, and she will agonize over her choice. Vianne heard the confession that lay beneath. He was telling her his own story in the only way he could, cloaked in Isabel's. He was saying that he had worried about his choice to join the army in the Great War, that he had agonized over what his fighting had done to his family. He knew how changed he'd been on his return, and instead of pain drawing him closer to his children and wife, it had separated them. He regretted pushing them away, leaving them with Madame Dumas all those years ago. What a burden such a choice must be. For the first time, she saw her own childhood as an adult from far away, with the wisdom this war had given her. Battle had broken her father. She had always known that. Her maman had said it repeatedly, but now Vianne understood. It had broken him. You girls will be part of the generation that goes on, that remembers, he said. The memories of what happened will be hard to forget. You will need to stay together. Show Isabel that she is loved. Sadly, this is a thing I never did. Now it is too late. You sound like you're saying goodbye. She saw the sad, forlorn look in his eyes, and she understood why he was here, what he'd come to say. He was going to sacrifice himself for Isabel. She didn't know how, but she knew it to be true just the same. It was his way of making up for all the times he'd disappointed them. Papa, she said, what are you going to do? He laid a hand to her cheek, and it was warm and solid and comforting, that father's touch. She hadn't realized or admitted to herself how much she'd missed him. And now, just when she glimpsed a different future, a redemption, it dissolved around her. What would you do to save Sophie? Anything. Vianne stared at this man who, before the war changed him, had taught her to love books and writing and to notice the sunset. She hadn't remembered that man in a long time. I must go, he said, handing her an envelope. On it was written, Isabel and Vianne, in his shaky handwriting. Read it together. He stood up and turned to leave. She wasn't ready to lose him. She grabbed for him. A piece of his cuff ripped away in her grasp. She stared down at it. A strip of brown and white check cotton lay in her palm. A strip of fabric like the others tied to her tree branches. Remembrances for lost and missing loved ones. I love you, Papa, she said quietly, realizing how true it was, how true it had always been. Love had turned into loss, and she'd pushed it away, but somehow, impossibly, a bit of that love had remained. A girl's love for her father, immutable, unbearable, but unbreakable. How can you? She swallowed hard, saw that he had tears in his eyes. How can I not? He gave her a last lingering look and a kiss to each cheek, and then he drew back, so softly she almost didn't hear. He said, I loved you too, and then left her. Vianne watched him walk away. When at last he disappeared, she returned home. There she paused beneath the apple tree full of scraps of fabric. In the years that she had been tying scraps to the branches, the tree had died and the fruit had turned bitter. The other apple trees were hale and healthy, but this one, the tree of her remembrances, was as black and twisted as the bombed-out town behind it. She tied the brown checked scrap next to Rachel's. Then she went into the house. A fire was lit in the living room. The whole house was warm and smoky, wasteful. She closed the door behind her, frowning. Children, she called out. They are upstairs in my room. I gave them some chocolates and a game to play. Von Richter. What was he doing here in the middle of the day? Had he seen her with her father? Did he know about Isabel? Your daughter thanked me for the chocolates. She is such a pretty young thing. Vianne knew better than to show her fear at that. She remained still and silent, trying to calm her racing heart. But your son, he put the slightest emphasis on the word, he looks nothing like you. My husband, and he struck so fast that she didn't even see him move. He grabbed her by the arm, squeezing hard, twisting the soft flesh. She let out a little cry as he shoved her back against the wall. Are you going to lie to me again? He took both of her hands and wrenched them over her head, pinning them to the wall with one gloved hand. Please, she said, don't. She knew instantly that it was a mistake to beg. I checked the records. There is only one child born to you. And Antoine, a girl, Sophie, you buried others. Who is the boy? Vianne was too frightened to think clearly. All she knew for sure was that she couldn't tell the truth, or Daniel would be deported. And God knew what they'd do to Vianne, to Sophie. Antoine's cousin died giving birth to Danielle. We adopted the baby just before the war started. You know how difficult official paperwork is these days, but I have his birth certificate and baptismal papers. He's our son now. Your nephew, then. Blood, but not blood. Who is to say his father isn't a communist or Jewish? Vianne swallowed convulsively. He didn't suspect the truth. We're Catholic. You know that. What would you do to keep him here with you? Anything, she said. He unbuttoned her blouse, slowly letting each button be teased through its fraying hole. When the bodice gaped open, he slid his hand inside, sliding it over her breast, twisting her nipple hard enough that she cried out in pain. Anything, he asked. She swallowed dryly. The bedroom, please, she said. My children. He stepped back. After you, madame. You will let me keep Daniel here? Are you negotiating with me? I am. He grabbed her by the hair and yanked hard, pulling her into the bedroom. He kicked the door shut with his booted foot and then shoved her up against the wall. She made an oof as she hit. He pinned her in place and shoved her skirt up and ripped her knitted underpants away. She turned her head and closed her eyes, hearing his belt unbuckle with a clatter and his buttons release. Look at me, he said. She didn't move, didn't so much as breathe. Neither did she open her eyes. He hit her again. Still she stayed where she was, her eyes closed tightly. If you look at me, Daniel stays. She turned her head and slowly opened her eyes. That's better. She gritted her teeth as he yanked down his pants and shoved her legs farther apart and violated both her body and her soul. She did not make a single sound. Nor did she look away. Chapter 34. Isabel tried to crawl away from what? Had she just been kicked or burned or locked in the refrigerator? She couldn't remember. She dragged her aching, bloody feet backward across the floor, one pain-filled inch at a time. Everything hurt. Her head, her cheek, her jaw, her wrists, and ankles. Someone grabbed her by the hair, yanked her head back. Blunt, dirty fingers forced her mouth open. Brandy splashed into her open mouth, gagging her. She spit it back up. Her hair was thawing. Ice water streamed down her face. She opened her eyes slowly. A man stood in front of her, smoking a cigarette. The smell made her sick to her stomach. How long had she been here? Think, Isabel. She had been moved to this dank, airless cell. 2 mornings had dawned with her able to see the sun, right? 2, or just 1? Had she given the network enough time to get people hidden? She couldn't think. The man was talking, asking her questions. His mouth opened, closed, spewed smoke. She flinched instinctively, curled into a crouch, squatted back. The man behind her kicked her in her spine, hard, and she stilled. So, 2 men, 1 in front of her and 1 behind. Pay attention to the one who is speaking. What was he saying? Sit. She wanted to defy him, but didn't have the strength. She climbed up onto the chair. The skin around her wrist was torn and bloody, oozing pus. She used her hands to cover her nakedness, but it was useless, she knew. He would pull her legs apart to bind her ankles to the chair legs. When she was seated, something soft hit her in the face and fell into her lap. Dully, she looked down. A dress, not hers. She clutched it to her bare breast and looked up. Put it on, he said. Her hands were shaking as she stood and stepped awkwardly into the wrinkled, shapeless blue linen dress that was at least 3 sizes too large. It took forever to button the sagging bodice. The nightingale, he said, taking a long drag on his cigarette. The tip glowed red-orange, and Isabel instinctively shrank into the chair. Schmidt, that was his name. I don't know anything about birds, she said. You are Juliette Gervais, he said. I have told you that 100 times. And you know nothing about the nightingale. This is what I've told you. He nodded sharply, and Isabel immediately heard footsteps, and then the door behind her creaked open. She thought, it doesn't hurt. It's just my body. They can't touch my soul. It had become her mantra. We are done with you. He was smiling at her in a way that made her skin crawl. Bring him in. A man stumbled forward in shackles. Papa. She saw horror in his eyes and knew how she looked. Split lip and blackened eyes and torn cheek. Cigarette burns on her forearms. Blood matted in her hair. She said, stay still, stand where she was, but she couldn't. She limped forward, gritting her teeth at the pain. There were no bruises on his face, no cuts on his lip, no arm held close to his body in pain. They hadn't beaten him or tortured him, which meant they hadn't interrogated him. I am the nightingale, her father said to the man who tortured her. Is that what you need to hear? She shook her head, said, no, in a voice so soft no one heard. I am the nightingale, she said, standing on burned, bloody feet. She turned to the German who had tortured her. Schmidt laughed. You, a girl, the infamous nightingale? Her father had said something in English to the German, who clearly didn't understand. Isabel understood. They could speak in English. Isabel was close enough to her father to touch him, but she didn't. Don't do this, she begged. It's done, he said. The smile he gave her was slow and forming, and when he came, she felt pain constrict her chest. Memories came at her in waves, surging over the breakwater she'd built in the isolated years. Him sweeping her up into his arms, twirling her around, picking her up from a fall, dusting her off, whispering, "Not so loud, my little terror. You'll wake your maman." She drew in short, shallow breaths and wiped her eyes. He was trying to make it up to her, asking for forgiveness and seeking redemption all at once, sacrificing himself for her. It was a glimpse of who he'd once been, the poet her maman had fallen in love with. That man, the one before the war, might have known another way, might have found the perfect words to heal their fractured past. But he wasn't that man anymore. He had lost too much, and in his loss he'd thrown more away. This was the only way he knew to tell her he loved her. Not this way, she whispered. There is no other. Forgive me, he said softly. The Gestapo stepped between them. He grabbed her father by the arm and pulled him toward the door. Isabel limped after them. I am the nightingale, she called out. The door slammed in her face. She hobbled to the cell's window. clutching the rough, rusty bar. "I am the nightingale," she screamed. Outside, beneath the yellow morning sun, her father was dragged into the square, where a firing squad stood at the ready, rifles raised. Her father stumbled forward, lurched across the cobblestone square, past a fountain. Morning sunlight gave everything a golden, beautiful glow. "We were supposed to have time," she whispered, feeling tears start. How often had she imagined a new beginning for her and Papa, for all of them? They would come together after the war, Isabel and Vianne and Papa, learn to laugh and talk and be a family again. Now it would never happen. She would never get to know her father, never feel the warmth of his hand in hers, never fall asleep on the divan beside him, never be able to say all that needed to be said between them. Those words were lost, turned into ghosts that would drift away, unsaid. They would never be the family Maman had promised. "Papa," she said. It was such a big word, suddenly. A dream in its entirety. He turned and faced the firing squad. She watched him stand taller and square his shoulders. He pushed the white strands of hair from his dry eyes. Across the square, their gazes met. She clutched the bars harder, clinging to them for support. "I love you," he mouthed. Shots rang out. Vianne hurt all over. She lay in bed, bracketed by her sleeping children, trying not to remember last night's rape in excruciating detail. Moving slowly, she went to the pump and washed up in cold water, wincing every time she touched an area that was bruised. She dressed in what was easy, a wrinkled linen button-up dress with a fitted bodice and flared skirt. All night, she'd lain awake in bed, holding her children close, alternately weeping for what he'd done to her, what he'd taken from her, and fuming that she couldn't stop it. She wanted to kill him. She wanted to kill herself. What would Antoine think of her now? Truthfully, the biggest part of her wanted to curl up in a ball in some dark corner and never show her face again. But even that, shame, was a luxury these days. How could she worry about herself when Isabel was in prison and their father was going to try to save her? "Sophie," she said when they'd finished their breakfast of dry toast and a poached egg, "I have an errand to run today. You will stay home with Daniel. Lock the door. Von Richter is gone until tomorrow." She felt her face grow hot. This was the kind of intimacy she should know. "He told me so last night." Her voice broke on the last word. Sophie rose. "Maman?" Vianne dashed tears away. "I'm fine, but I must go. Be good." She kissed both of them goodbye and rushed out before she could start thinking of reasons to stay, like Sophie and Danielle and Von Richter. He said he was leaving for the night, but who knew? He could always have her followed, but if she worried too much about what-ifs, she would never get anything done. In the time she'd been hiding Jewish children, she had learned to go on despite her fear. She had to help Isabel. "Don't come back. I'll turn you in myself. And Papa, if she could." She boarded the train and sat on a wooden bench in the third-class carriage. Several of the other passengers, mostly women, sat with their heads down, hands clasped in their laps. A tall Hauptsturmführer stood guard by the door, his gun at the ready. A squad of narrow-eyed Millis, the brutal Vichy police, sat in another part of the carriage. Vianne didn't look at either of the women in the compartment with her. One of them stank of garlic and onions. The smell made Vianne faintly sick in the hot, airless compartment. Fortunately, her destination was not far away, and just after 10 o'clock in the morning, she disembarked at the small train station on the outskirts of Girol. Now what? The sun rode high overhead, baking the small town into a stupor. Vianne clutched her handbag close, felt perspiration crawl down her back and drip from her temples. Many of the sand-colored buildings had been bombed. Piles of rubble were everywhere. A blue cross of Lorraine had been painted onto the stone sides of an abandoned school. She encountered few people on the crooked cobblestone streets. Now and then a girl on a bicycle or a boy with a wheelbarrow would thump and rattle past her. But for the most part, what she noticed was the silence, an air of desertion. Then a woman screamed. Beyond came around the last crooked corner and saw the town square. A dead body was lashed to the fountain in the square. Blood reddened the water that lapped around his ankles. His head had been strapped back with an army belt so that he seemed almost relaxed there with his mouth slack, his eyes open, sightless. Bullet holes chewed up his chest, left his sweater in tatters. Blood darkened his chest and pant legs. Her father. We have come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hannah. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.